Here we are, moving into beautiful autumn and cultivated audio for September 2025. Who knew Murray Grays and Fireflies could provide a match made in heaven? But it did, for Chrissy and Tim Thomas in Bozeman, Montana, at their Stillwater Ranch, and they know that Murray Gray breed. I'll be sharing that chat we had, along with some great culinary info from Eileen Napier, a co-owner of Ramstead Ranch. There's no waste in a natural system, and Eileen's experience making bone broth will, I'm sure, inspire more than a few of us to get in the kitchen and use those bones. So grab your earbuds and/or shovel, and let's dig in. Let's start with the more poetic side of things by having you tell us about how grazing by Firefly became the story behind your regenerative journey.
When we bought our farm, it was just a bare field, and it was a part of a large family section that had been split and divided amongst siblings. And nothing had been built on the place, and it was just being leased to a local cattle rancher, and there was a bit of overgrazing going on. Not a lot of management besides just weed spraying here and there and running cows on it. So it took a couple years of us being here and using the land differently until we were out late one evening and just happened to see these fireflies. We'd never seen them in Montana before. Everybody we had talked to was just beyond belief. So we immediately started asking the extension office and any of the locals that we knew, and really nobody knew anything about them. They were all just pretty surprised that we had fireflies. It just wasn't a heard of thing.
Wow.
So we finally got a hold of the family who was a part of the family trust and sold the farm, and they said, oh yes, we do occasionally have fireflies, and they're really only here on this road. They're not a common thing. And they were pretty surprised at how plentiful the fireflies were that year. They said, I don't think we've ever seen them like that. And ever since that year, these bugs have continued to flourish and repopulate. And now they're so dense in June that the whole field is just a field of glitter. And I really do believe that that has to do with Tim's management practices. He's very aware of the fireflies and where his cows should be at certain times of year. He doesn't use any chemicals on the field. He tries to avoid tilling at all costs. And I think that those practices have really flourished those fireflies. So it kind of helped bring it to light as to what this type of management can change in relation to the life in the earth, in the soil.
Certainly. And boy, it just makes me feel very grateful that I grew up around fireflies. They are pretty rare.
Yeah, yes. That's rare here.
Yeah, that's amazing. I did see one thing, that haying is certainly a factor in the firefly's life. Do you adjust your methods for haying around that? Has that been a creative problem-solving event for you?
The areas where the fireflies are at, we don't really hay. We only graze at certain times of the year. In the spring, you don't want to be on the field because it's too soft a ground, so you want to make sure that it's dry enough and you're not trying to squish them. You need to let the grass grow a little bit taller in June when they're out so that they can have an easier time with their reproductive stuff.
Yeah, so I would say he has modified exactly how he uses the land, and he'll delay certain things. There is a point after their reproduction cycle that their larva is put back into the ground. And so that's kind of a safer time for that land to be used. But we're just finding different ways to utilize it that don't impact them.
Isn't it amazing how the ripple effect works? I mean, you started at this point, and yet look how everything has come up all around that. So once again, nature for the win and for the full
circle.
Yeah,
absolutely. And with the fireflies has come the dung beetles and other types of insects. And then we're noticing a lot of ground nesting birds. We had just a huge population of savanna sparrows this year. And we know that they are capitalizing on that. More bugs, more birds, better crops, better
better grass, better forages. So.
Yes. Yeah. Well, let's move into a little bit of numbers here. Tell us about your land, where you are, your acreage, rainfall maybe, and types of livestock and numbers of livestock that you currently have. When did you get started?
I think we started 10 or 15 years ago. We had bought this place about 15 years ago. The home base around the house is 160 acres. We only get about 11 to 12 inches of rainfall. In the summer, it can hit 100 degrees, and in the winter, we've seen actual temperature at 55 below.
Oh, boy. My goodness. And then you got your Murray Greys. Is that the only kind of livestock you have? And how did you get started with having Murray Greys, of cattle breed that you have?
I've been raised a commercial rancher my whole life, and then we kind of moved away from the family place. And when we bought this property, we wanted to get back into cows, so we bought a few different types of cows and really kind of liked the Murray Grey disposition and the ability to produce a really good beef product on grass alone.
You said you started out buying a couple, and then how did it grow? Where are you at now, 10 or 15 years later? How many do you have?
Does anybody know how many cows they have?
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm so naive. What can I say?
Right now, currently, we have about 70 that will calve in the year, and I think we have 20 or 30 yearling heifers that'll be bred for the first time this year, and probably 10 or 15 bulls that we're developing, and then however many steers we have at the moment.
What made you settle on the Murray Grey breed? Is that what your family did, or did you branch out into this yourself?
Tim's family, they have kind of a mix over there, so they're pretty commonly using the black baldy cross onto a Charolais bull. But they've kind of ran every breed throughout the years. And basically, Tim's family helped establish his cattle management ideals of you're breeding cattle for fertility first and you're culling, you know, less productive cows. So he learned a lot about how to bring cows up that were good herd members and functioning animals. One thing that his family's commercial herd didn't have was disposition, and he's hidden under a tractor from an angry mother cow more times than he can count.
Oh,
and so when we started with Murray Greys, I grew up a horse girl. I grew up in rodeo. Besides roping calves every summer, I really didn't have a lot of cattle experience as far as cow-calf operation. And one thing he was concerned about was I'm an animal lover, and I'm probably going to get eaten alive by a couple of these mama cows if I'm not really careful. And sure, I could have learned, but what we found with the Murray Greys is that is a pretty consistent breed trait. They are a very docile animal. They're very good with people handling their calves. They're a smart animal. So that was kind of the big draw. I preferred the Murray Greys because I could walk out in the field with my dogs during calving season and not feel like I was being hunted. And that was something that I noticed right off the bat raising Murray Greys beside our other cattle breeds. And so they just sort of started filtering themselves out, and we just started focusing more on the Murray Grey. And now we're connected to so many Murray Grey breeders, and we have Murray Greys from so many herds across the country. I can say with certainty Murray Greys are docile across the board. We've had a couple here and there. They always go to the sale barn and sell by the pound, you know, that are a little higher headed, or you have to watch them when they're calving. But 90% of the time, these Murray Greys are docile cattle, easy to work with, and perfect for a management system such as Tim, where you're in close contact, you know, mob grazing, intensive grazing, you're moving them every day, sometimes twice a day. You really want cattle that are easy to work with, low headed, and know how to function in that environment.
Well, it just seems like efficient is a word that comes up in reference to Murray Greys so much. And it just makes me wonder why more people don't have this breed. Is it growing by leaps and bounds? Have you seen that over the years that you've focused on them?
The breed has seen a couple blooms and busts throughout the years. I think there are a couple restrictions in the breed that have maybe held it back a little bit.
One is an organized registry system, and the fact that there are so many registries that we end up with a lot of animals that get dispersed amongst those registries, and then they kind of get lost in the mix. And so as far as having registered Murray Gray cattle and for people to focus on that, the breed is still very small due to a lot of factors. So I think the demand is there. I think more people would buy and own Murray Gray cattle if they were available. And so that's what we've been trying to focus on. The biggest issue with Murray Grays is there's just not enough of them. Right. And I think if more people put their hands on them, I think more people would utilize them in their herd.
Just to go back a little bit here into what you were talking about with the registration, you said there were too many different organizations registering them?
Yeah, you know, I think this is kind of a touchy subject, but I think this breed contains some of the most passionate cattle breeders I think we've ever met. And sometimes when people butt heads, they decide to go a different direction than the direction that they're going and
sounds religious
from situations. So that's happened over the years, and basically the registries have split and divided. And even though we have a very small herd base, you know, I would say probably less than 5,000, probably even less than that, Murray Grays are born in the United States a year. I think we have four registries right now. Two of them are pretty inactive. And then, of course, there's the American Murray Gray Association that is the historic and original Murray Gray registry. And so I think keeping track of the animals as they've displaced among these registries has been kind of the challenge as far as keeping purebreds available for buyers.
Right. Some busy work during the winter months, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Busy work all year, really. We have to fit it all in somehow, but.
Of course. Yeah. Let's go into actual physical qualities of the Murray Gray carcass. How do you describe that quality, and what do you look for when you see a Murray, and then what do you expect to see in the carcass?
I think one of the attributes of Murray Grays that isn't talked about enough is Murray Grays in the beginning didn't chase the show phenotype. And when you chase the show phenotype, you're reducing your carcass quality in the fact that you're increasing your bone size and connective tissue toughness, and you're losing tenderness. That's purely opinion-based, and I know this is a debated topic, but from what we've seen, a show phenotype will not have the tenderness and cutability and eatability as an animal that is selected for carcass quality. And so one thing that we see consistently in Murray Grays is tenderness. I think I read an article one time that said that the average tenderness score, now we're talking about genomics,
mm-hmm, yes,
of an American Angus, is going to be under a score of 5. Our Murray Grays, without even selecting for tenderness, typically come in above an 8. There was one time we ran all of our cattle in our herd, and 90% of them were an 8 or above genomically in tenderness. That is a pretty consistent trait in Murray Grays. The other thing that they can do is marble very easily off of grass. But I think that utilizing tenderness is more important when you're grass finishing animals, because what you need is time with a grass animal. And time is what costs you your tenderness. So if you're finishing a steer in 14, 15 months, that is not genomically inclined to be tender, then you're probably pretty safe because that's a pretty young animal. But when you live in Montana and you have to bring your grass steers into their second summer and you're finishing between that 25 to 27 month range, tenderness is your what you can fall back on. So if you have a difficult season, if you have a difficult winter, if for whatever reason you have to bring those steers longer to be a well-finished grass animal, your tenderness is something you can fall back on. And that's something the Murray Grays do extremely well.
As far as continuing the breed goes, between higher dress out yields and weigh out value, how do you weigh out the value of a reduction in marbling versus higher dress out yields?
Let's see, how am I trying to say this here? So when you're pushing carcass size, when you're pushing those large muscles on an animal, that's when you're going to be reducing your tenderness, and that's when you're going to be increasing your yield, right? If you have an animal that bears a little bit less muscle, but yet softer connective tissue and more tender meat, your marbling comes from when you're finishing them. So it depends on the finish that you're putting on that animal. I think some of them are going to be more inclined to marble than others, but really the marbling comes from the finishing level of the animal.
Another question I have, as you're working with a breed and you want a tender meat, does it go along with smaller bone or less bone?
And I should knock on wood when I say this, but our cattle run in pretty difficult country in the summer.
Yes.
They're at high elevation and they're on the steep and deep in Montana. And we have never had any issue, knock on wood, I'm going to say this again, with broken limbs, broken legs, any of that. And that goes across our finer bone animals to our more denser bone animals. And it's not that we don't have both. We do. We find value in having animals that meet more industry standards with larger frame, bigger bones. And we do run a few cows like that that we think are worthy of producing bulls for our commercial customers. So we run both side by side. But Murray Grays, the breed, and the American Registry do not discriminate against finer bone animals, because I believe there are enough studies out there to really indicate that finer bone animals do produce a more quality carcass. It might not be bigger, but it will be better eating.
What you spoke about earlier, that offset of having a more docile breed is worth so much, so much.
Yeah, it really is. Our cattle up there in the high country, you know, sometimes we'll go a couple weeks without checking on them. We'll run up there and we can really just yodel from the gate and they will come running out of the mountains to see. And we don't cake our cows. They don't get any kind of benefit other than just a greeting. They probably think we're going to switch them pastures. And so, you know, that's really why they're coming. But there's some motivation there. But they are. They're so docile. Our cattle are more of a pull when we're moving them. It's more of a pull rather than a push. They will kind of follow you where you would like them to go. And that's a big transition. We always joke that our cattle will ruin your cowboy dreams, because they really are so easy to work with that you can kind of throw all those old Western traditions out the window.
Yep. A breed like this is so welcome, it seems like. What is the downside of the Murray Grey? Is there a downside?
Let's see.
Are there illnesses
They're hard to find.
Yeah.
Difficulty in finding. Yeah. I think like any breed, we're victim to consistency. There are traits in Murray Grays that are very consistent. But if you're marketing Murray Grays as a grass animal, you still have to find breeders that are focusing on grass animals. If you want to be in show and you want to be competitive with carcass competitions, you're going to need to find those breeders that are knowledgeable and breeding and selecting for that. And so I would say that that really plays into the versatility of Murray Grays. There's really something for every industry within this breed.
Wow.
But I think one thing that's held back the Murray Grays is they've been marketed specifically to grass raisers. When we have many animals here that would do perfectly well in a feedlot environment, they would be competitive with other animals in the feedlot environment, and they have more of that industry focus from their heritages. So I think that's probably something that's restricted the understanding of the animal. Is just they're so versatile. Anybody can take them and do whatever they please based off their selective breeding. But it also has been a downfall, because some people might get into them thinking they're buying a grass animal, when in reality that breeder actually focused on, you know, maybe they haul their calves to the market in the fall and they need those longer, leaner steers that sell better to feeder buyers.
Right. Well, that's certainly something to be aware of if you're going to be a buyer. If someone were an experienced cattlewoman or cattleman and yet checking out the Murray Grays was a new experience for them, what would they be surprised by, or what would they look for and perhaps not be looking at the right thing? Would size be the obvious one? Or
I think in any breed, whatever breed someone's choosing, they need to be looking for a breeder to buy from that aligns with the same goals, and I think is the biggest thing with that.
That sounds exactly right, yes.
And I think breeders need to know what they have, too. And that comes down to Murray Grays attract a lot of new cattle people because of their docility. And these are just things that take years, decades, sometimes generations to understand the different types of cattle that can be within a breed. And, you know, there's a long time saying that within a cattle breed, there's more diversification in genetics oftentimes than there is within two cattle breeds. And so, you know, that's just going to be in any breed. And I think Murray Grays fall subject to that too. You know, we have a lot of new imports that are focusing on carcass size. And then we have a lot of old heritage lines that are very focused on smaller frame grass types. And so we have to find our placing in that mix. And we have to really, really understand how to market our cattle to the broad range of needs in the industry. Because I would say probably 90%, maybe even more, of the industry of raising beef in the United States is feeder cattle, larger frame, larger carcass.
Of course,
and,
yeah.
And so we really have to find our foothold in what breeders want to be raising for.
Yeah, and I thank you both for, in a sense, leading the way into maybe not what people should be looking to do, but hopefully they are, you know, by doing the grass-fed. And is there a very obvious difference that you see of the grass-fed and finished Murray Grays to the ones that are finished on a lot of corn, or as far as the meat quality goes?
I think we've had good Murray Gray steaks on both ends of the fence there. Murray Grays, they do exceptionally well in a feedlot environment too. When you focus more on those larger frame, bigger carcass animals, they can eat, they're efficient, they marble. They can really do both. And I can't say that we've had a bad Murray Gray steak. Honestly, the best steak I ever had before a Murray Gray was a Texas Longhorn. And I thought, why is everybody buying into this Black Angus thing when there's other breeds with different hide colors that produce good steaks? And it wasn't until we had a Murray Gray that I thought, well, now this one takes it to a whole new level. And now you have to finish them right, you know, just like any other animal, especially with grass. You have to be very particular on how you're finishing your animals. But they are just able to do it so much better for us than we've had experience with in other breeds.
I think the flavor profile of a Murray Gray is different than a lot of the other beef breeds.
How so?
I would agree. So we were finishing our steers on grass before we had Murray Grays. And, you know, every now and then you just get that off one that had kind of a gamey flavor to it. And I kind of lost a little bit of confidence with our finishing on these steers. And I thought, what are we doing wrong? They look finished. Everything seems right. But they just have this little bit of a stout flavor that it just wasn't to my palate. So as we started moving in those 50% Murray Grays and then down into purebred Murray Grays, that wasn't a factor anymore. And we've noticed that among our customers too, where oftentimes we'll give samples or we'll do like a farmer's market type deal and people will try our beef and they'll say, I've never had grass fed that didn't have that kind of elk flavor to it, that
right,
gamey
yes.
flavor. And so I think you probably could produce that gamey flavor under the right circumstances, but I think Murray Grays make it harder to do that.
Mm.
And we've yet to bite into a piece of fat that had that flavor. And so I think they're just a
nice.
Milder flavor. It's just a different profile. And I can't explain it right now, maybe in 30 years, but there's something to it because I think everybody unanimously agrees on that within the community, the Murray Gray community.
Yes. I know you do a lot of testing for your calves, and the myostatin is something that certainly you look for. Maybe you could just describe that a little bit and why somebody maybe wouldn't mind if one was a known carrier of the NT821.
So myostatin can be fairly common in Murray Grays. So I'll start with our concerns of that. Everybody is looking for steers that have good muscling ability to finish, whether it's on grass or in the feedlot. And what we find with myostatin is it could be used as a crutch. So you look at your input crutches, and then you can look at your genetic crutches. And myostatin can be, in my opinion, in our opinion, considered a crutch. When you have an animal that produces 10% more muscle on its carcass by a genetic mutation, that's not a consistent trait. That's not something where if you kept a bull that was a carrier of myostatin, that he would pass to all of his calves. If a carrier is bred to a non-carrier, potentially up to 50% of his offspring will be carriers as well. And then potentially 25% of those might show a slight affection of that. A single copy of myostatin is typically not noticed in the ways you would expect. So we do have quite a few, I wouldn't say quite a few, I'd say we have a handful of myostatin-carrying females. I can tell you they're easy fleshing, they raise a great calf, they're good cows, but we've culled just as many because they were inconsistent in what they produced. So we're keeping cows that, despite their myostatin, they will produce a good calf every year. So the reasons I think it would be beneficial is if you are putting calves on a trailer in the fall and you're looking for more weight at the sale, you will get that from myostatin. That will absolutely happen. It might not be in all of your calves, but it will be in a great deal of them, and you're just going to get paid better. And so whether the longevity of it and all of those other factors that come into NT821, that's kind of breeder preference. But as far as where we're going with our herd, we want to make sure we're not crutching our genetics on a mutation that's inconsistent.
I'm sure you guys have a great reputation within this community. And are you finding that you are able to sell before you even go to market? What is that like for you?
So we do an annual sale. We just started doing this last year because we've run quite a bit of a waiting list, and we're so thankful for that, that people trust us with their herds. I would say the demand for Murray Grays is extremely high, specifically Murray Gray females. And I think most breeders don't have problems selling their registered animals. I think if they put them for sale, they're usually sold pretty quickly.
Yes.
And so, I would say we could pre-sell our calf crop every year if we wanted to. But we like to retain our heifers, develop them through the winter, make sure that they, you know, hit grass in the spring and have not tapered off in growth. We want to make sure that they breed within 45 days. Really, we want to see those heifers breed within 3 weeks of the bull being turned out. And so then those heifers then go into our sale as a bred heifer. And that's just kind of our assurance to make sure we're moving our genetics forward and we're really focusing on that fertility and seeing, too, that they will produce as a grass animal.
Wow. There's a lot of quality with what you're doing. Thank you for that. And Tim, before our interview, you mentioned that you'd like to weigh in about the pricing and what's going on with all of that right now. And you mentioned there are some surprises about it. What's your feeling about what's going on with all of that now?
The beef market in general right now is pretty high. If you've been taking anything to sale, the prices that you've been getting at the sale yard are historic right now, and they keep getting higher. And I think that when people do the farm to table thing and they sell, it's kind of been hurting that person. The last few that we finished, we penciled it out and figured out that we'd lost like about $800 an animal. Mm-hmm. If I would have just taken it to sale and sold it at sale versus selling it to all of our customers. Okay. So I think that the industry is getting rid of the farm to table a little bit because the prices are finally where they should be on cows.
Right. Now, is that a part of the whole ranching experience that you enjoy, or is it best just for you to go to market and then see your neighbors and friends when you can?
Yes, absolutely. It's a labor of love. And, you know, we love having a stuffed freezer of Murray Gray, and we have good relationships with, you know, our processors and all of our customers. We have a huge network of return customers now that they are becoming passionate about Murray Grays. But for us, finishing our beef is not only about that community, you know, network. It's also about making sure that our genetics are geared for that. And so it's very difficult to sell an animal that finishes on grass if you're not finishing them on grass yourself, because one bull can change your entire calf crop for the next year. And so just keeping those genetics aligned with our mission, making sure that we're able to understand the bulls that are in our paddock and what they're going to produce. That helps our seed stock customers as well as our beef customers.
Yeah. Tim, is there anything from your family's generations of ranching that you feel has influenced you most?
Yeah, I think one of the things that is a little bit different is at the end of the day, you have to be able to make a little bit of money or at least break even in most years. You know, you develop a relationship with some of the animals and they're like your best friend, but if they don't breed on time or if they don't raise a calf or anything like that, then you have to make some pretty hard decisions. And so at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how friendly they are or how pretty they are.
Yeah.
if they don't do their job, there's only really one place for them.
Oh, well, I don't know. I'd be nervous being a rancher's wife, I think.
Hopefully that doesn't apply to humans.
Yeah, no, it doesn't sound like it does. Well, what's your favorite part of your day?
Well, let's see. Probably, you know, we really do enjoy going up and seeing the cows on the grass in the summer. At home, it can get a little bit stressful. You know, those first couple weeks when the cows are turned out, you're so excited and you're moving cows every, you know, 6 hours or so. And then it kind of starts to wear on you a little bit. You know, this time of year, our cows are up in the high country. This is a great selection process for us too. They're in very high elevation and they really need to be efficient with their forage up there. It's all undeveloped pastures. And so I think driving up there and observing how the calves are growing, how the cows are doing, making sure that everybody's feet look good, nobody's having any trouble with the rocks or dryness, really just looking at your herd, evaluating them, overthinking everything. We love it.
yeah, for sure. Well, that certainly shows. And Tim, have you noticed night and day difference with your acreage doing the mob grazing and...
Yeah, it is pretty crazy, the difference, but it doesn't happen overnight. And so with the regen thing and intensive grazing and stuff, for the first couple of years, you feel like it's not doing a lot or it's not doing as much as it should for you.
Right.
But then when you take a five-year picture, like this year in one of our fields that had been really thin grass, we could have grazed it 30 days probably after we had taken our first grazing, which,
that's amazing.
You know, 5 years ago, we couldn't even graze that field for a quarter of the time that we were on it this year.
Yeah.
So, and then all of the wildlife and like Chrissy was talking about, the bugs and the fireflies and the birds, there's so much more life here than if you just overgraze things and, you know, don't care as much.
Right.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah. Yeah, but you get to see what your efforts are worth.
Yeah.
One thing I'd like to interject into this department here is I think you really have to be comfortable with things not looking as pretty as you planned. One thing I did not anticipate with Tim's regenerative movement was there are going to be years of weeds, and they're going to drive you nuts. And there's going to be odd growth. You're going to have blooms of strange things. Last year we saw a big bloom of death camas. We don't know why. It just came out of nowhere. When you're hand pulling weeds, or at least at the most, your spot spraying to get rid of some of these noxious weeds, your soil is just going through that adaptation process where it's regenerating itself and those buried seed banks are coming up. And that has probably been one of the hardest things for me to watch, deal with, coming from conventional systems and get past it. And, you know, I think you'll have your old timer neighbors driving by and say, oh man, they've got
right.
a sweet clover, a mustard bloom this year. They should take care of that. Well, we are in a way, you know,
yes,
in our own
yes.
way. And this is going to take time, but it's just a matter of getting those cows on there, getting them to stomp it down, making sure that they're not selecting what they're eating. They're getting rid of it in time. And I think that's one of the hardest things about this method. And I think, too, when you're managing cattle in the regenerative model, specifically the mob grazing and non-selective grazing, one factor that seed stock producers need to consider is
you can alter your production cycle with your cows. So you can reduce your performance in your cows very easily. And we've gone through those motions, and we will still go through those motions. There's going to be years where our cattle are not going to look as good as they could have. And that's because we're not feeding that performance into them. We're requiring them to be non-selective in what they're eating. And so there's some protesting involved. There's some cow discontentment. You know, you put on your earphones, but our cattle phenotypically are not going to look the same as someone that's really prioritizing their cattle's wishes. So I think from a seed stock perspective, there are challenges with it there too.
That's the brilliant point to bring out. Thank you for saying that. And both of you, thank you so much for what you're doing. And just one final question. What's your favorite cut of meat?
Oh, boy. We like all beef. We're pretty partial to a rib steak, though. I'd have to say that's probably the first thing we go through.
Yeah, we have to test that first, I think.
Right. Yep, that's our it's important.
We go through a lot of burger, though. It's very versatile, and I think that's the one thing we sell out of the most, or the quickest.
Eileen, your co-owned family farm, Ramstead Ranch, grew from a two-acre backyard poultry operation to an over 200-acre farm. It sounds like the universal support was definitely shining down.
Yes, that is definitely true. Dan and Jean Hayes and I own and operate Ramstead Ranch together, and it definitely grew out of our own backyard because we were inspired to raise our own healthy foods. We started with veggies, and then we got introduced to Michael Pollan and Joel Salatin, who had lots of empowering messages about how you can do this yourself with chickens in your backyard and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, we embarked on a grand adventure to raise healthy pasture-raised meats, and it was going so well that it just kind of kept growing and growing into what is Ramstead Ranch today.
Yeah. So tell us where Ramstead Ranch is and what livestock you do have today and what you're producing for yourselves and the public.
Yes. So Ramstead Ranch is located in the northeast corner of Washington State. We're north of Spokane, about 70 miles north. We're almost in Canada. We're almost on the Idaho border as well, so tucked up in the corner. It's literally on the way to nowhere. We're up here at the end of the dirt road. So it's
I like
quiet,
the sound of that. Yes.
And pristine, really. It's really beautiful here. We currently grass feed and grass finish cattle, and then also pasture finish hogs in our mixed woodlands. So like silvopastures where there's trees and grasses together. And so that's our current focus. We also have a flock of beautiful sheep who produce gorgeous hand-spinning fiber, and of course they're cute lambs. And those are our animals that we focus on today. But we've done it all. We've raised chickens, layer chickens, meat birds, turkeys as well, butchered those ourselves as well throughout. And we have an awesome team here that helps us with sort of order processing and fulfilling orders for customers who want healthy pasture-raised proteins for their families as well.
Yeah, that's lovely. Well, you all certainly have embarked and really gone after the full regenerative picture. Your meats and just starting out with a few chickens. And as with all farmers and ranchers, there's an expertise that grows daily in all of these directions that are involved in living and working on the land. And today I'd like to go culinary with you, actually, and talk to you about bone broth. I'd say it's more an acquired talent, more than an acquired taste, because usually bone broth is just so delicious. I'm wondering, where should we start today? Would it be with choice of bones?
Sure. Out of just a passion for honoring the whole animal, that if we're raising these animals ourselves, we value their life, we value all that they give us, and by utilizing the most of what they give is, in our opinion, one of the ways that we can show honor to what they have given us. And so being able to use the bones to extract more nutrition is a big deal, and it definitely feels rewarding, not only because we're utilizing more of what that animal has to give, but it's also incredibly nourishing for our bodies. And then, like you mentioned too, it's delicious. So it's easy to love all aspects of this. In my experience, the type of bone is not as important as just kind of coming up with a system that works for you, because all the different types of bone are going to impart flavor and different nutritional profiles that are good for you. And I think the most important thing is just doing the work and getting it into your kitchen in the easiest way possible so that you'll do it over and over again and not make it hard or a heavy lift or a chore to do. That if it's fun and enjoyable, you'll do it more often, which means you'll have more value on your table and you'll have an easier time of it as well. So it's more fun. I would say starting with the steps of what makes it easy is probably a good place to start.
I like that.
Yeah.
So what made it easy for you? You just mentioned using different types of bone. So would you say, just like they say, oh, butter from the spring is the best because the cows are getting that fresh green grass and there's more vitamin K and things like that. Is there something like that for the bone broth?
Well, I would just say source the best quality bones you can. So if that means grass-fed, grass-finished to you, go for it. If it's your own cow that you've raised in your backyard, regardless of how it's been raised, use those bones. The bones that work best are sort of the joints. In cattle, the butcher will often save the knuckle bones because they have the most cartilage in them, which imparts the most nutrition and the gelatin to the broth that's going to make it nice and thick. But honestly, there's many other parts of those bones that have joints. So we just have everything boxed up. Just throw it all in, in a mixed bulk case if you're going to a butcher, if you're home butchering, or if you're just eating in general, any meats that you're eating at home. If you have a T-bone steak, throw that T-bone as soon as you finish the meat, throw the bone into the freezer and collect up a stash, so to speak, from what you're normally eating and enjoying. And when you have a good bundle of meats that fits the pot that you're working with, you're ready to go.
Right. So can you run us through the size pot, how many bones or approximately how much you would throw in, and then what do you add to make it taste really good?
Absolutely. If you say you have a 5 to 6 quart saucepan, which is just, I think most kitchens would have one of those, I would expect to use about 3 to 4 pounds of bones in that. And that's going to be a good size to fit that saucepan, and you're going to cover with water and you're going to simmer. If you have the option, a crock pot, I think, is a better way to go, because with a saucepan, you're going to have to put it over a source of heat that heats from the bottom, which is going to, A, you're going to have to monitor that, and you risk scorching and whatnot. If you have something like a crock pot, or even better yet, a turkey roaster, you know, they make those large size, they're basically giant crock pots that fit a whole turkey, and they hold 21 quarts, I think is what's the biggest I've seen. That's a great way to go. That's kind of like the Cadillac model, where you can fit 12 pounds of bones in there and get more bang for your buck, so to speak, of time spent.
Right.
And in those cases, the heat's coming from the sides. So anything that settles to the bottom is not at risk of burning and causing a bad flavor or scorching and stinking up the kitchen and that sort of thing. So if you have the option to use a turkey roaster, that's my favorite. And then as far as what to add, before we add anything other than bones, I recommend roasting the bones. When our customers come back and they've tried to make bone broth in their own home, and they report, oh, I didn't love the flavor. I think I did everything right. It gelled really well, but I just didn't love the flavor. 10 times out of 10, they admit, well, I didn't roast the bones. So don't skip that step, because that's what imparts amazing flavor to our meats, is when we actually get that nice roasted flavor. You've heard a flavorless boiled chicken is like sort of a measuring stick for like terrible, boring, bland food that you would get in a cafeteria or something like that. It's because it didn't hit a good temperature to make the flavor pop. Meat needs that. It needs to hit a certain temperature to get a good taste from it. And that happens in broth making by roasting those bones first. And that's a simple step, 350 in the oven for about an hour or until they're toasty. And, you know, I turn them and make sure they get all golden brown on all the sides. And then I start my broth making process.
And I imagine it's almost like baking, where you would start smelling it, right? You'd start smelling it
kitchen,
and then you know it's getting ready.
Definitely, yeah. You got to step out of the room and then come back in to notice that, oh, wow, your nose gets fatigued and you don't notice the smell until you step out and come back in, and then it's lovely. Yeah, so roast those bones first, and then whatever pot you're using, you fill to cover them with water, and then you start the simmering process. This is another point where there's probably two different schools of thought, where should I add vegetables now if I want to, or should I add them later? And for me personally, I don't add veggies at this point. I want to taste the vegetables if I'm adding them. And so I wait until the end. But there's definitely a lot of people that like to throw in veggies now. And if you do, it's going to impart a really very rich color to your stock. It's going to make it very dark and really just kind of change the flavor profile. You're not going to get as much nutrition out of any veggies that you add at this point because you're going to be simmering for so long. That's going to break all those delicate vegetable minerals and vitamins and whatnot down more. So there's that piece of it. But I know a lot of people, like, they swear by, I put the veggies in early and then it makes this really rich, robust flavor. And I can definitely believe that and would say, hey, try it both ways as you're going through the learning process. Make a batch one way, see if you like it, and then try a different way the next time. Everybody's got a different favorite way.
So, of course. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And what about herbs?
Herbs, too. I would put them in the same category as vegetables. So mm-hmm. I'm more of an add at the end because I really want to taste that flavor. That's why I'm adding it. I'm adding for flavor. But it's up to you. And it's really the sky's the limit. You know, what flavors do you love? What herbs are your favorite? And just try them out. I recommend doing it every way to your heart's content.
Yeah, each time is a new adventure, I would bet, just because of the season mm-hmm. and what's available. Is there exactly. or are there a group of herbs that you feel like you like the most? And we'll also know this is your preference.
Absolutely. But the asterisk here is this is my opinion and my preferences. But celery, and it's not an herb, but you know, celery or celery seed, I think is a win almost every time. So celery seed and then garlic, of course, onion, those are some of my favorites. If I'm doing beef, especially if I'm doing beef, I like to do onion and mushrooms. Mm. And again, with those ones specifically, I add those at the end because beef can have a very strong flavor that maybe needs a little help culinary wise. And so that's why I basically always plan to just saute onions and mushrooms in a pan and then add them to the broth at the very end and then let them steep for a little while. And that just makes the flavor pop.
Is there a particular yeah. oil you use when you saute, or butter or
lard? Yeah.
Lard, of course.
I'm lard first because, again,
yes,
we're regenerative farmers. And so we do as much as we can from the land. And so we render pork fat down to make lard. So that's a great way to go. But, you know, any oil that you love, olive oil is another good one.
Yeah, just thinking about all of the supplies that you have. I mean, right now it's harvest time for my menial garden that I do here. And
yeah.
then add all the
yeah.
apples in North Boulder, making applesauce and dried apple rings. It's just incredible just to have such a bounty and to have the time to actually make it happen. But actually, it's
Absolutely.
Not time necessarily, is it? You schedule it in and you just make it happen because now is the time when it is.
Right, right. And, you know, bone broth making is a great thing to do when there's nothing else going on.
Right.
In my opinion, that, you know, when we're in the deep cold of winter, that's a great time to be simmering things in the kitchen for a long time. You know, you don't mind
yes.
the heat. This time of year, it's probably better done outdoors, you know, maybe on a porch or in the garage where you can keep the heat out of the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
That is also helpful. The heat and humidity, too, depending on kind of your living situation. But, you know, if there's a lot of steam from the simmering, you know, you may want to keep that outdoors depending on what time of year you're doing it.
Right. And this yeah. is a super novice question, but do you ever mix bones or is a bone
Absolutely.
A bone?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I recommend it.
Okay.
And the same thing with the veggies, too. Before we leave the question of veggies, adding veggies, too, I also wanted to mention a lot of people will add the odds and ends that they don't use. You know, like if you're making a salad and you're cutting the tops off the carrots and the tips off of things, instead of tossing those to the trash, you might have a stash of veggie discard that goes in your freezer, too, and waits to be added to the broth pot when you're ready, because you don't need those perfect vegetables. You can use the odd bits that you've trimmed out because really you're just trying to extract the most nutrition you can.
Right.
So,
is there a time
yeah.
once you do put in your veggies and your herbs, is there a time that you cook those and then you're removing them, I'm assuming, yes?
Yeah. So when I'm adding vegetables, I'm usually adding them when there's probably an hour or two left to simmer. Because again, for me, I want the height of the flavor. So I don't want those flavors to break down a lot when it comes to veggies. So I wait till, like I said, the last hour or two, and then I toss them in.
How long at that point has your broth been simmering?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we try to go 72 hours. We like a long, slow simmer.
Right.
So it really is at the very tail end. But, you know, again, going back to, I think the most important thing is that you're trying this out on a schedule that works for you so that it's repeatable, so that you'll do it again a second time. So if that's not realistic for you and your schedule, if you can get a good 24 hours in, do it. Your broth is going to be amazing. You're not less than because you can't do it, you know, for 3 days straight or whatnot, you know.
Right.
So try it out and just do what you can so that you will repeat it and so that you make it a part of your schedule, your cycle, your rhythm. And I do recommend if you're going for a shorter time that you add some apple cider vinegar, because that will help extract some of the nutrients from the bones, especially if you're doing it for a shorter period of time. If you're simmering longer, like I'm saying the 72 hours, the apple cider is not going to really make any difference. The bones are spending enough time in the heat to get the extraction process.
Right. Completion. Well, that's interesting because yeah. I thought you would just do that as a matter of fact, add the apple cider vinegar. Mm-hmm. Great point. Well, thank you, Eileen.
Yeah.
Boy, it's amazing, isn't it, when you start looking back through history, how much a medicine this has been throughout all of time, isn't it? I know the Japanese are still quite the advocates for boiling it down and down until it's just a gel, and then they spoon it out as medicine.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And, you know, if you think about it over the course of history, there would have been, you know, like a perpetual broth pot going on and where you're always adding something as a base for whatever's being cooked, because there's always a piece of something that to discard, and it just goes in the bottom to help with flavor profile and to not waste, right? Because it was a precious resource that was meant to be honored and utilized to the fullest. So definitely. And again, I think we changed the topic there, but different types of bones, I absolutely recommend mixing and matching, because it's amazing. They don't necessarily taste like you think they would. We do broth classes with new people. Folks sign up and they just want to learn about it and get a little hands-on. And I always like to play the sample game and go, okay, I'm going to offer you this broth. What animal, what bone do you think it came from?
Right.
And it's so rare for anybody to guess the lamb bones correctly, because most people have this preconceived notion that lamb has a strong flavor and that it's going to be gamey or all of these things. We have these prejudices about what it's going to be like, and it's lovely and light. People often guess poultry when they try it. So I say, whatever you can get your hands on, give it a go and try a batch that's pure lamb, but then try a batch where you mix it a little bit. You'll be surprised. The flavors that I love the best are probably pork, surprisingly. Pork bone's lovely, especially with that celery, the celery seeds. That, I think, is the most universal. That broth is the most popular. People have more opinions about the beef broth or even the poultry. Pork is even probably more universally popular when we try it in our classes than even poultry broth, which is probably what most people have the most experience with, right? A good chicken noodle soup. Yeah. Or turkey after Thanksgiving.
Of course. Well, you mentioned prejudices, Eileen. And one thing I want to ask you, just so no one's going to go, oh, she had the girl talk about making broth, and I know you are as much an integrated part of this ranch and farm as everyone else. So is there a favorite chore that's very farm and ranch-like that you can share with us?
Well, that's a good one. And I'm going to pick we have a piece of equipment that's called a SkyTrack. It's like a telescoping forklift. It's my favorite piece of equipment on the ranch, and I love to drive it. It's for, you know, if we're lifting pallets, or we used it early on when we were placing our chicken tractors around in the pasture. We were using chicken tractors that were, first of all, I should go back. A chicken tractor is a pen that houses and protects your chickens that's able to move forward on a daily basis, so that the chickens are always moving onto fresh pasture and leaving their fertilizer behind to help it augment and improve the health of the soil behind where the chickens have been. And so when I say chicken tractor, that's what I'm talking about. And they're often awkward and heavy. And when you got to go put 20 of them out in the field, that's a big job. But this SkyTrack, you could fork the chicken tractor up in the air and carry it up high, and it articulates. So if you're on a sloping hill, you can tilt it and still carry your heavy load. So that's probably one of the things that makes
so
like,
fun.
If that job is in place, I'm raising my hand and going, I want to do that one.
That's great. Is there anything about the broth that we missed that you want to say before we close today?
You know, the other question a lot of people have is, what do I do with the fat? And that's another one that's like, you got to figure out what your preferences are, because you can leave the fat in and have it really rich. And when you add it to your rice or whatnot, it's imparting the fat and the flavor there. Or you can let your broth cool off and you can pull the fat cap off and not have it be part of your broth. But I still recommend you save it, because then you can use that fat cap for sauteing your beans. Use that fat elsewhere in your kitchen as a cooking oil. So when you fry up your eggs or when you're cooking up your next veggies, you can use it there instead.
Perfect.
Especially if you're using pasture-raised bones, that's where a lot of the added nutritional value is in the fat. So don't waste it. It is definitely an asset.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. I was right about your expertise, so thank you very much. Really fun.
You're so welcome. I hope you and your listeners find it valuable. And if you ever have more questions, you can write us. Ramstead Ranch is on the website, ramsteadranch.com. You can write with your questions. We are so happy to help.
And it's amazing that this is just another way where we can perhaps not just go to the shelf at the health food store looking for expensive supplements. We can try integrating things like this more into our diets.
100%. You can get your omega-3s and your gelatin, your collagen in your delicious meals.
Thanks to Chrissy and Tim Thomas and to Eileen Napier. For anything we do here at Cultivated Audio, it's cultivatedaudio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.